This is a podcast from the Refugee Study Centre. To learn more about our work, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk.
Welcome to the afternoon session of the workshop. My name is Oliver Bakewell. I'm co-director of the International Migration Institute, and I'm very happy to be able to have this role in chairing this session this afternoon. I'm so impressed that the Oxford Migration Studies Society has been able to organise this conference. I know so many of the people organising it have been involved in doing their coursework and exams and dissertations. So thank you for organising this and inviting me to take this role. Sorry I wasn't able to be here for the whole of this morning. It's my pleasure to introduce three speakers this afternoon for the session on migration, transnationalism and social change. And I think this morning there was a particular focus on the crisis, particularly the crisis in Syria. And perhaps in this session we move a bit away from that to think about more about ongoing processes of migration in the Middle East and North Africa, which affect and are affected by the changing political situation in the region. And first we look at one of the major centres of immigration in the region, Saudi Arabia, which has drawn in migrant workers to sustain its industrial oil-led development and economic growth, and at the same time has consistently restricted the rights available to those migrant workers. So I'm delighted that Hélène Piolet has been working on this for, well, I don't know how long, quite some time, from Sciences Po, is here to talk to that. And then we'll then be turned to Morocco, which has been, you could almost say, it's a classic country of emigration, seen large numbers of its citizens moving abroad, many to Europe, initially as guest workers and then becoming long-term residents and citizens of the EU. And the question that we're going to be exploring is about the relationship of these Moroccans abroad with Morocco. It's been a subject of intense interest for the Moroccan state. And so I'm delighted that we have Nadia Bourras, right? Got that?
Fantastic.
Right, yeah. Okay. From the Assembly of Overseas Moroccan Community Council, based in the Netherlands, who will speak on that. And then the third paper takes us back to the heart of the Arab Spring, if you like, the so-called Arab Spring, when we look at Tunisia. And we look at how the political revolution in Tunisia has transformed the interactions between migrants and the homeland, and perhaps changing both the forms and possibilities of action. And so to speak to that, we have Julia Breda, who's based at the University Ca' Foscari in Venice. Ca' Foscari.
Very well.
In Venice. So I hand the floor to Hélène first.
So welcome to this afternoon panel, and I wish to thank first Katrina for inviting me to this event and the Oxford institutions that are sponsoring it. It sounds weird, probably, to start with Saudi Arabia and the GCC countries, as you're well aware, Arab Springs did not happen there. So it's a weird assignment that I was given to talk about something that did not happen. So instead of talking about something that did not happen, I'm going to try and talk about something that did happen there and try to put this back into a sort of analytical/critical framework of what revolutions and social change and social movements are, which is not extremely easy. So it's very much a sort of discursive process that I'm trying to start here. So basically, I'm going to start with a long detour, introductory detour through theory about the difficult analytical connection between mobility and revolution. Then I will try to talk about anti-immigrant policies as they are implemented in Saudi Arabia and other GCC countries, together with labour market policies and reform, as anti-revolutionary policies or anti-revolution policies, sort of medical measures to prevent revolutions. And the third point is not going to be really a third point, it's just going to be a conclusion on the impossible research agenda around migration and social change in Saudi Arabia and the GCC country, which is, of course, my research agenda. So the analytical link, not link, between revolution and mobility is very much evolving around the puzzle of causality, which, you know, what is causing what? Is mobility causing revolution? Revolution or social change causing mobility, which is very much a sort of development theory, both political development and economic development theory based question. This puzzle of causality is sort of embedded in the case study that we're focusing on today, which is the Arab Springs, as mobility being both a cause and a consequence of the uprisings. And of course, Nick Mantilla's presentation today, later today, is going to address that through sociological, you know, prism. And I also have written about it in a French-speaking publication. So, to jump in the question of social change and uprisings, maybe we just have to go back to a little bit of a definition of social change and the potential continuum that there is between social change and uprisings or revolutions. It might not be a continuum, and this is very much up to definition. So we have, on the one hand, revolutions, rebellions, social movements, as Sitara puts it, or great transformations, economic revolutions leading to social, socioeconomic changes and political changes. Of course, I'm thinking here about the Great Khal, Polanyi, and that is opposed to coup d'etat or independence movements or restoration of civil power after military rule or top-down political changes. So two different sets of changes. The question remains about violence. Is violence a defining criteria for revolution as opposed to social change? That might be our light here. And we see that in the case of the Arab Springs, we do not have the same level of violence. If we want to work as, World Bank advisors, we have, ladders, scales of to evaluate violence. And of course, this has a connection. Violence has a connection to forced mobility. Not that there is no forced mobility without violence, but that violence is a defining criteria, as we saw this morning, to grant refugee statuses and asylum to asylum seekers. So it's important, however. What is a political revolution? Oh, I have text. Sorry, not used to the appearing thing. Okay, I'm very bad with this. So what is a political revolution? If we want to get a definition, I'm just offering this one. Of course, there are many others. So political revolutions are rapid changes in the institutions of government carried out by non-institutional means and usually with the support of popular groups mobilized for demonstrations, local revolts, guerrilla warfare, civil war, mass strikes, and other revolutionary actions, which is sort of opening a spectrum of possibilities here. So that's the sort of consensual definition. Of course, we have to factor, if we want to think about the Arab Springs, we have to factor in this, a definition of political revolution, the notion of social change. And social change could be defined as a bit more of a challenging definition. Here we do not only have a new government or new political leaders, or even some new institutions. We have a new state, which is resting on new social elites with new social and political institutions and different legitimizing myths for those institutions and the state and novel conceptions of the political community. So it's really sort of uprooting of practices, institutions, and identity within a particular society. So it's more than the political revolution, if you want to put it that way. And of course, And of course, my reference here could be someone like Theda Skocpol, who defined social revolutions as rapid, basic transformations of a society, state, and class structure, accompanied and in part carried through by class-based revolts from below. So we're adding here something new, which is the from below. But it's coherent with my initial definition of revolution opposed to top-down political change, right? But this, of course, has as a definition, has a history, and it's part of the theories of revolutions that have been, you know, out there in the skies for quite a long time. And those theories have been focusing, and here you see I'm going back to my initial question on the causes and consequences of revolutions, focusing on the causes, both structural, of course, and contextual of social changes and revolution. And these have been the main focus for international relations theories, comparative politics, etc., etc. And of course, we have the Marxist legacy. I'm not going to go into depth here. And the different changes in the system of productions, class structure, and political order, with both the local dimension of the Marxist analysis and, of course, the international dimension through, for instance, the Leninian approach to imperialism. And this, of course, is also embedded in the approach of Theda Skocpol, of course, but also Charles Tilly and Norbert Elias when they talk about social change in a socio-historical perspective. And a less ideological, I said non-ideological, one would say less ideological approach to revolutions and social change, talk about social transformation, and putting the emphasis, in the case of Elias, on culture, for instance. So basically the idea here is to interlink different factors of social change and revolutions and different scales of analysis. Factors would be social, political, economic, and scales of analysis could be local, regional, international, or transnational. But those theories hardly ever address migration and mobility as social change. Social change and migration and mobility being considered as this diffuse phenomenon, so not coinciding with the momentary and rapid change induced by the notion of revolution. What we have here is a set of complex factors, but also let's try and reintroduce in there a non-deterministic approach to social change. Of course, structures are important, and the approaches that I just outlined really, really briefly put the emphasis on this, but we can rather talk about structures of opportunities than rather than deterministic structures that are determining behaviors. And of course, timelines are progresses, not progress in the positivist sense, but processes are important. So when we look at domestic and international causes and consequences of a social change and revolution, of course, we have to look at the integration of a revolutionary moment in a process and continuities and discontinuities. So that could also be another version, a historical version of the structure versus agency dilemma. It could also be something else. If we look at the Arab Springs, we have intertwined causes and facilitating factors, socioeconomics, unemployment, food crisis, demography. Of course, those are linked for youth, unemployment causing opportunity of mobilization for Arab youth. Lack of political participation or lack of democracy, delegitimization of authoritarian regimes, and human factors. That would be my agency part. And I'm thinking here about bloggers and also individuals like Mohamed Bouazizi. And we also have processes, phases of revolutions, from social uprising to constitutional reform, from popular to religious-led uprisings, social change and political change intertwine. And of course, we're only living the beginning here, and we have to think about time acceleration. Of course, we talked about this morning with the acceleration of the at the refugee crisis in Syria. I'm going to try and be on profile. I hope it's my best profile. This is less important. It's about the consequences of revolution, and a lot of IR theorists and historians have thought about the diffusion of revolution, especially Kurt Wieland, but also Theodore Scott-Paul and Stephen Vault. And this is, of course, interesting in the case of the Arab Springs, because you know people were talking about contamination, about the diffusion of the movements and the connection, especially through internet and other social media. So that can also be interesting. So, but why is all this interesting for us, this big detour, introductory detour? On the one hand, mobility has not been factored in the analysis of sociopolitical changes and revolutions in the region, or not so much, and not factored in as such, that is to say, as a vector of social change. But transnationalism has been studied in this context, especially through transnational activism, opponents in exiles, or the theory of the fifth column. Okay, so transnationalism is there in the general media analysis and even, you know, academic analysis. International factors are there, both as causes and consequences. I talked about the diffusion theory. But migration and social change, if we look at it from sort of a generic point of view, for the host country, the connection is an interest for the socio-cultural transformation in host countries induced by migration and for community formation, as Stephen Castles put it, both in the short term, so that could lead to the fifth column syndrome, it's a community formation having foreigners settling, and also in the long term. So it could induce change in identity, values, strategies that would translate into domestic politics. So that's important. Migration and social change for the country of origin this time. Of course, it's about transnational activism. It's about social remittances. Perfect. And diffuse social change. But it's also about socioeconomic changes induced by remittances, not the social one, the financial ones. So change in the, not the social, but the social, change in the distribution of wealth because of migration and social classes and elites, and potentially another great transformation, change in the structure of the economy. That might be also the case, especially if you think about human capital. And in between those two poles, you have transnational communities and activisms that are not located in a particular country, but with transnational causes, as scholars working on transnational social movements are talking about, and global impact on transit countries, for instance, and Libya is an interesting example for that. Also global impact on civil society, a civil society that might also be global, as Saskia Sassen puts it, and social impact loops, what Durkheim calls a boucle de rétroaction, when a change in a particular place induces change, that induces change, that induces change. Anyway, how to connect this with the Saudi context very rapidly? Well, with difficulties, indirectly, and by changing the usual research agenda on the GCC. What happened in Saudi Arabia, or rather, what didn't happen? An Arab Spring didn't happen, so no uprisings. What happened in Saudi Arabia was a short-lived and very localized uprising in the eastern part of the country based on socioeconomic claims and sectarian inequalities. Basically, Shia population in the city of Al-Khatif, which is within the oil producing area of the country. Short-lived and managed by the state through different ways, coercive and non-coercive. What did not happen, or what does not happen, is this: migrants claiming their rights. Okay, this did not happen in Saudi Arabia. This picture is from the UAE. A mini uprising happened in Bahrain, but I'm not talking about it. The general research agenda on Saudi Arabia and the GCC country is shaped by a very normative narrative on how international migration is happening in those countries. Basically, migrants are being imported, they stay for the term of their contract, and when they are done working or their employers have had enough of them, they go back. Okay, that's the narrative. The other part, another part of the narrative is that the state is implementing anti-integration policies based on segregation and other exclusionary practices, okay, creating or enforcing very hierarchical societies. That's the basic narrative. And of course, we know that this is particularly important because there are lots of migrants in the GCC country. We see that here. We see that here also, the share of migrants in the local populations. And this is about, this is Eindhoven's map on the origin of migrants. And these are my data. The usual suspects of this research agenda and linked to this narrative are economics of dependency to labor migration, questions of xenophobia and racism, segregation, exclusions, and migrants' rights, and of course, migration policies and control. So if we look at what the... I have 1 minute?
Yeah, I was just going to guess.
Yes? So if we look at what Saudi Arabia has been doing in the recent times, it's basically been the enforcing or the enforcement of this vision of migration in the no social change option, the absence of impact on migration in the country. So the reform that have been carried out in the past 2 years are labour market and immigration policy reforms to promote the employment of Saudis, both male and female, to participate in the state-building process and modernisation process with a not-so-hidden agenda in mind, which is preventing a revolution, as the equation between high employment among youth and revolution has been well processed by policymakers as soon as 2011. And I've written a little bit about that. So basically, the reform is to prevent the risk of a revolution by putting Saudi young people, you know, introducing them into the labor market. And if you, they can't go and work in the private sector, by giving them benefits, unemployment benefits and allowances. And of course here we see that there is a large share of the labour force that is foreign and that unemployment is not so high according to official statistics, but actually quite high if you look at the impact of the recent reform. We thought that there were about 12% of unemployed Saudis up to now, and it appears that they are much more than that. And especially among women, but women are not so much a problem because the Saudi state doesn't think that women are going to go on the street and, you know, be revolutionary. So it's targeting male rather than female. So I have a lot of slides on data which are not extremely important, but this one is showing that there is a peak of unemployed youth, which, you know, started the red light in the mind of policymakers. So unemployment, still unemployment. So the different policies, NITACAT, which is addressing the categories of employment and companies, a corrective campaign to deport migrants, up to 1 million last year, have been implemented. The results are increased control, limitation of the duration of stay, but that's not so sure. Enforcing deportation, that's very, very sure, especially for Somalis and Ethiopian. And externalizing control to recruitment companies. And this is, of course, taking me to my very rapid conclusion on changing the research agenda from the political economy of migration control and protection of migrants' rights to something about, I mean, keeping those research agenda. I'm not saying that they're not worth it, but also introducing migration social change in the Gulf countries, especially connecting this to the political sociology of the state, looking at how migration brings social change, how emigration brings social change back home, and that's it. Thank you very much.
afternoon to all of you, and thank you for inviting me. First, I would like to thank Katerina and all those who worked very hard to organize this this workshop. I was asked to be here today, and I was listed as a member of the CCME, the Conseil de la Communauté Marocaine à l'étranger, the community of Moroccans living abroad. But that's not my only function. Almost 2 years ago, I finished my PhD research on Moroccan migration to the Netherlands and transnationalism. And so I'm not only here as a member of the CCME, but also as a scholar, and my presentation would be actually focusing on the topic of my dissertation, which is out in Dutch, so it's not going to be of any use for you. But and in my dissertation, I talk about Moroccan migration to the Netherlands from a historical and gender perspective, but at the same time, I look at individual transnational ties maintained by migrant men and women. But also I look at how Morocco and the Dutch state, how they influence these transnational involvements or activities or ties over time, because there is a development in that. So, I'm a historian, so I'm going to start by an example, something that is going to be useful, I think, for this for my talk. And I want to start in 1963, the summer of 1963, actually, when the American president, John F. Kennedy, visited Ireland, the birth country of his great-grandparents. Thousands of enthusiastic people welcomed him and cheered him as the long-lost son. So in New Ross, where he had his speech, he said, and I quote, "The sons and daughters of Ireland, spread all over the world, belong to the best and most loyal citizens of the countries they migrated to. But at the same time, they maintain strong ties and memories to their country of origin." End of quote. So the next day, the New York Times opened with the headline, "Arrival of President Kennedy in Ireland feels like coming home." 3 decades later, in 1995, the Irish president, Mary Robinson, addressed the Irish Parliament in similar terms. She said, and I quote, "Cherishing the diaspora is a moral obligation. The relationship with our diaspora can teach our society the values of diversity, tolerance, and justice." End of quote. You might think, what has Ireland to do and John F. Kennedy with Morocco? But it's coming. In 2008, the former Moroccan minister of Moroccans living abroad, there is actually a ministry that focuses on issues concerning Moroccans living abroad. He declared in a newspaper article that, and I quote, "The Moroccan community abroad is considered by Morocco as our 17th province," end of quote. This actual statement caused a lot of turmoil, especially in Dutch public and political discourse. I will talk about that in a bit. He made this statement as part of the new policies addressed by the Moroccan king to reinforce the ties with Moroccans living abroad, especially the cultural, family, and social ties. And again, Dutch newspapers especially, and some politicians, they couldn't muster this Irish enthusiasm as happened a couple decades ago. And they criticized very heavily the Moroccans' so-called interference with their nationals living abroad. The previous speaker spoke about transnationalism as an analytical tool and something that is discussed in scholarly discourse when we talk about migration. And in this case, and I focused in my dissertation on the Dutch context, transnationalism was considered as a threat, economic threat, because migrants were supposed to spend their money in the Netherlands and not sending money back home, but also as a cultural threat because having all these ties with the home country would mean that they don't have any interest in learning the Dutch language, for example. And then there is this political threat that they are primarily loyal to the Moroccan king and the Moroccan state and not loyal to the Dutch state. This topic, actually, I researched that very extensively and I reported on that in my dissertation. So, but I'm not going to talk about that here. So what I will discuss today with you is I'm going to explain why sending states or countries of origin, why they want to maintain ties with nationals living abroad. Countries of origin not only determine who will stay in the country and who will leave the country, for example, by granting them work permits or helping them in recruitment policies, but they also develop policies with regard to those who left. That's not something new and it's not unique to the Moroccan case. Already in the 19th century, Germany, Italy, Poland, classic immigration countries, maintained strong ties with their nationals abroad. And countries of origin implement these policies for several reasons. Economic reasons is the most obvious reason, in stimulating foreign investments and tourism, securing remittances, but also mobilizing political support. The American scholar Laurie Brandt argues that these arguments mainly apply to Western countries. And her research from 2006 shows that non-Western countries are driven by other motives. For example, we can explain why countries are interested in maintaining ties with their national living abroad by looking at macro-historical explanations. So changes within the communities abroad will trigger new responses from the governments in the country of origin. But also safety and stability explanations. For example, controlling political support by political opponents abroad. So in short, the fact that countries of origin maintain ties with the communities abroad is not new, and it certainly does not only apply to non-Western countries. How and why countries of origin maintain these ties depends on domestic and international events, and Morocco is no exception to this. I would like now to, in the remainder of my presentation, I would like to talk about and discuss with you why and how the Moroccan state maintains these ties with their nationals living abroad. And since the topic of this workshop is also Arab Spring, I will talk about that in my closing remarks and explain very briefly why Morocco dodged actually the Arab Spring. So for the sake of convenience and time, I will discuss Morocco's MRE, Marocains résidant à l'étranger. That's the official term for Moroccans living abroad. So they are considered citizens and not subjects, but that also changed over time. And I will do that by making a distinction between the regime of the previous king, King Hassan II, and the regime of Mohammed VI, who is his son, and his rule began in 1999 after the death of his father. So to understand why the Moroccan state initiated all these policies towards their nationals living abroad, we should take into consideration the domestic political events in Morocco during the 1970s. Yes, since the beginning of Hassan II's power, since the beginning of his rule, he reinforced his already very harsh and repressive reputation. Political opponents were silenced, were jailed, or killed. And student organizations and unions, for example, were banned and forbidden. So to reinforce his political power, he granted the army more power and gave them privileged positions within the Mekhzen, the regime, his the administration elite. So, But however, the new balance of power turned against the king, and in the summer of 1971 and a year later in 1972, the king narrowly escaped two attacks on his life, and both coup attempts were came from high-ranked army officials. These failed coups prompted a more repressive regime. It was very hard and very difficult for political opponents, especially the leftist movements, to organize openly. So the only possibility for them to organize and to oppose the regime was to organize themselves outside of Morocco. So to start, they began to organize in France, in Belgium, in the Netherlands. And it was a very strict and support, a very strict and very well organized movement with people who fled Morocco as political activists, but also back in the 70s in Europe, especially in the Netherlands, there was this climate of anti-fascist movement. So they got a lot of support from left political parties in the Netherlands and other NGOs who supported them. So it was in this climate of social and political unrest that the king realized that he had to take action across borders to guarantee the domestic political stability and to maintain his sovereignty. So the events in Morocco, but also the international events, the European immigration stuff from 1973 onwards, family reunification, and the new composition of the migrant communities, they became larger, and there was a gender balance, so more women joined their husbands in Europe. So the community was bigger and more organized. So all these events in Morocco, but also outside Morocco, triggered responses from the Moroccan regime in relation to the MRE. Morocco had to act in order to continue to make a claim on the loyalty of the Moroccans living abroad. So it was in the mid-1970s that Morocco for the first time institutionalized ties with nationals living abroad by establishing Les Amicales, Amicales in Dutch, the friendship organizations. Officially, they were formally, they were supposed to help Moroccan communities abroad by organizing social and cultural events. But in fact and in reality, they served as controlling apparatus, a state-sponsored controlling apparatus, and they monitored and intimidated political opponents and made sure that the regime was not threatened by these political activists. So migrants' political activism, transnational activism, if you will, instigated Morocco's first institutionalized interference with Moroccans living abroad. These state-sponsored organizations, Les Amicales, they created a climate of fear, intimidation and distrust, and as a result of that they encountered a lot of resistance from this very well organized political activists, but also from the countries, from the host countries, the countries of settlement. They ceased to exist in the mid-1980s because they never recovered from their bad reputation, and at the end even the king himself ditched these organizations. So now he had to come up with new solutions to secure the loyalty of his citizens, of his subject. In the beginning, they were subject living abroad. Because in this period, it was still believed, and we're talking about 1960s until the end of 70s, beginning of the 1980s, it was still believed by all parties involved that Moroccan migration to Europe was temporary. So quick already. So the perception of migrants as a possible source of unrest and threat to the regime was not a specific Moroccan vision, but typical of authoritarian regimes. The same occurred in Spain during the Franco regime and in Poland during the interwar period. So the point I'm trying to make here is that besides economic motives, political and safety motives play a very important role in explaining why countries of origin develop ties with their nationals abroad. Let's move to the MC's years, Mohammed VI's years. His father left him an appalling legacy: human rights violations, secret prisons, torture, corruption, censorship, and international territorial conflicts. Some of the conflicts still exist today. So after his accession to the throne in 1999, MC's, Mohammed VI, largely distanced himself from the politics of his father. He allowed his father's political opponents back into the country because they were persona non grata during the reign of Hassan II. In 2004, he set up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that investigated all the crimes that were committed during the rule of his father, the years of lead. Victims of the regime testified on national television and spoke about the hardship they went through during those years, decades actually. So, some people, because of this, some people argue that it was that Morocco dodged the Arab Spring because Morocco experienced its own Arab Spring in the beginning of 2004. That is an argument. It's maybe we can speak about that a little bit more when we have the discussion. So the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission stated that Moroccans living abroad were also victims of Hassan's repressive regime. And because of that, new relationships with the communities living abroad should be developed, should be taken up. So one of the main recommendations was that the Moroccan state should establish new relations and should set up a council renew its relationship with the Moroccans living abroad and give a voice to Moroccans living abroad, because previously that has never been done. All interests of Moroccans living abroad were represented by a representative of the Moroccan regime and not by migrants themselves. So for the first time, migrants and their children were allowed to speak about their wishes and their in relation to the Moroccan regime. So in 2007, the king announced the creation of the CCME, and he stated, and I quote him, "The democratization process demands participation of all Moroccans, wherever they are based, in the spirit of strong commitment and responsible citizenship." So now they are considered citizens and not subjects anymore. The king stressed that he wanted to reinforce the spiritual, cultural, and family ties. He pledged to develop plans to guarantee Moroccan migrants full participation in all aspects of Moroccan public life. So the CCME has 36 members, including former political opponents. And the active participation of former opponents of the regime, those who opposed the regime and were considered enemies of the state back in the 70s, were part now in this institution. And this shows that the regime clearly wanted to have a new relationship with Moroccans living abroad. So the most important task of the of this institution is to advise the Moroccan government on issues regarding Moroccans living abroad, for example, the nationality law, for example, because Moroccans living abroad are also considered Moroccan and cannot denounce their Moroccan nationality. And again, to stress a clear break with the past that migrants and their children were allowed to partake, and advice on the mutual relationship before, and as I said, representatives of the Moroccan state were responsible for immigration issues and policies. The creation of the CCME caused a lot of turmoil, a lot of public and political distress, especially in the Netherlands, as I mentioned, and it has to do with the history of the Les Amicales in the Netherlands, because more than in other countries, well, also in France, but especially in the Netherlands, the Amicales encountered a lot of criticism, and the creation of this CCME reminded people of this old relationship with the Amicales, and the old accusations of intimidation and state interference resonated in the new criticism of the CCME. some people, especially within the Moroccan community, believe that the CCME would hinder Moroccan migrants' integration into Dutch society. So the CCME was established in 2002. I think it's the reason why I participated in this institution is because when I was asked in 2007 to have a role in this, I said yes, because at that time I was working on my dissertation, which was on Moroccan state's policies towards Moroccans living abroad. So for me, it was a great opportunity to, from a very close, to be engaged and to see how things work. So it was born out of optimistic motives. But I think it's too soon to tell whether or if the CCME will be able to influence Morocco immigration policies. But I would like to stress, and then I'm going to end, that by setting up the CCME, the Moroccan state extended a hand to the Moroccan communities abroad. And this is, in fact, a break with the past whereby Les Amicales, as the regime's long arm, acted as the regime's main advisors. This metaphor from long arm to extended hand reveals in a nutshell how the Moroccan state MRI policies developed over time. Thank you.
So, good afternoon, everybody. Hi, you can read. My name is Julia Breda. I graduated at Kafuskar University with a work on the effect of migration on the country of origin. This thesis stems from a 2-year experience in Tunisia from 2011 to 2014, where I worked within different research projects, and I collaborated with the Tunisian NGO Association who working on migrants and refugees' rights. So I'm very happy to present the part of the results of my thesis here. It's a great opportunity for me since a few days ago I got the news that I got a scholarship to continue my researches at Nice University, so I'm not based anymore at Kafuskar. So I'm excited about sharing with you my work. I hope you'll find it interesting, and if you have any comments or feedbacks, I'll be glad to discuss with you also later in the coffee break. Yes, so the presentation I'm prepared for today aims to discuss how the Tunisia democratization process is influencing the way of acquisition and transfer of social capital of marginalized migrants from Tunisia. In particular, I focus on the fact that the end of the regime's oppression has consequences. On one hand, the open up of a space for freedom of expression and association in Tunisia, and on the other, made Tunisian borders become more porous in both ways, especially for people involved in social movements. So this brought to an unprecedented and relevant contact between Tunisian and foreign civil society, representing a new way for migrants and their social groups in Tunisia to build new social bonds, and providing access to resources and tools useful for raising awareness on their needs. So I know that in the next session of the conference, there's another speech about the Tunisian revolution and the consequent social change, so I will not go deep in the issue. But I still want to point out some key elements that are important for their influence in the migratory context. I structure my presentation in two parts. The first one point out the main events related to the Tunisian political, social, and migratory context, aiming to give a contextualization of the core of my research, and that will be presented in the second part through the analysis of two case studies of new contacts between foreign civil society and migrant social groups. Okay. So first part, about the revolution, which is called by Tunisian the Revolution of Dignity, and that represents a fracture in Tunisian history, whose political system was characterized since the independence in 1956 by an authoritarian and non-democratic regime, controlling the population through a system of informers and the threat of the police politique, the political police. So with the end of the oppression by the regime, after more than 50 years, Tunisian society experienced the end of the fear of state institutions and enjoyed a sudden freedom of speech and association. The feeling of freedom and the will to proactively experience this freedom spread widely through Tunisian society. In fact, since the juridical obstacles to the creation and work of association were removed in 2011, Tunisian civil society is playing an active and major role in the democratization process. Since the aftermath of the revolution, Tunisia experienced the establishment of hundreds of new associations working on all kinds of social issues. And the culmination of this process was the organization in March 2013 of the World Social Forum, which was held for the first time in an Arab country, and was characterized by a significant participation of Tunisian association. So how this social and political change affected the Tunisian migratory context? In many ways, I chose to point out the events that I consider the most important to give a brief overview of the general Tunisian migratory context before focalizing on the core object of the presentation. So the first one is the Lampedusa crisis. Once the government fall and the police and Coast Guard control of borders was suspended after the revolution, tens of thousands of Tunisians took the sea to the Italian island of Lampedusa, as you all know. And what's interesting is that according to the testimonies collected, this massive flows of departures represented for migrants themselves the normal continuation of their fight for freedom. So they were able together to withdraw 50 years of dictatorship, and together they were challenging also the barrier imposed around their border by the visa system and the state's migration policies. This challenge of borders cost just in 2011 around 1,800 lives of migrants while crossing the Strait of Sicily. Another challenge faced by the young Tunisian democracy is the debate on the establishment of an asylum system. In fact, in 2011, Tunisia hosted the arrival of tens of thousands refugees from the Libyan conflict, hosted in Shusha refugee camp in the south of the country until June 2014. Today, the country still does not have an asylum system, despite the signature of the Geneva Convention and the pressure from the UNHCR and civil society. So refugee status issued by the UNHCR gives no rights in Tunisia. As a third point, I want to talk about the change in the approach of the public authorities towards Tunisian abroad, which seems to be changing. In fact, the government switched from a tendency to control and report about the activities of the Tunisian abroad to the willingness of involving them in the country institutional reconstruction. In fact, their participation in the national policy of the post-revolutionary Tunisia was significant, as evidenced by the fact that six ministers came from Tunisian immigration. The consequence of the democratization that I'll focus on the next part of the presentation is how the new space of freedom opened up after the revolution attracted a number of foreign people involved in civil society movements in Tunisia. Some of them moved in Tunisia for long periods, working in association or NGOs, while others started regularly visiting the country, going back and forth, supporting and helping the connection between the association in Europe with the Tunisian civil society. This context also helped representatives of the Tunisian association obtain visas to attend international civil society meetings abroad. And this is exactly what I mean when I say that borders became extremely porous, because this kind of movements, circular movements of civil society, before the revolution were completely absent. Okay. So we move now to the second part of the presentation, where I want to describe two examples, two of the many examples of how marginalized migrants and their social groups are profiting of this new freedom acquired following the revolution in terms of new social ties established through transnational social movements, providing access to resources and tools useful to raise the concerns at the decision-making level. First of all, I want to precise that with marginalized migrants, I intend people who either reached Europe irregularly or became irregular at some point of their migratory experience. And their precarious condition influences heavily their daily lives in the host country, and in particular, the possibility to broaden their social network, as they often live marginalized and in fear of being caught by the police. However, in some cases, they come in contact with civil society organizations in the host country who provide them with the support and services denied by the public institutions to them. And if before the revolution these new social ties acquired abroad were confined to the host country and were unlikely to directly benefit the migrant social group in Tunisia, the fear of the regime in Tunisia was... these new social ties with the civil society abroad were confined in the host country because of the fear of the regime in Tunisia, who was an obstacle to any kind of contact between the local population and activists. Today, instead, this obstacle disappears, and it is possible to observe some significant cases in which a direct bridge is created between new social network of migrants abroad and social groups in Tunisia. The first example I want to talk about is the story of a migrant from northeast Tunisia. I think I have... If it's working, yeah. So this is the website of the campaign. It's the story of a migrant from northwest Tunisia. He lived in Europe for many years without a residency permit, and during this experience he had the chance to get in touch with Afrique Europe Interact, a group of activists who helped him regularizing his situation. His engagement within this activist network helped them carry out several events in Tunisia since 2011. In particular, an info tour on European and Tunisian migratory policies was organized in different regions in Tunisia and stimulated the birth of a local association of students. These events led to the creation of a network in Tunisia that has spread to different cities in the country and involved people from different social classes, so researchers on migratory issues, migrants, family, return migrants, refugees from Shusha refugee camp, students and activists from the Tunisian and international civil society. These social ties continue to be active through information exchange and support in case of need still today. As a second example, in 2011, following the disappearance of around 1,000 Tunisians trying to reach Europe by crossing the Strait of Sicily, their families gathered together and started organizing protests and sit-ins in Tunisia. In fact, with the hope that their sons had reached Italy, as they recognized some of them in the Italian TV news, or because they received phone calls from their mobiles, these Tunisian families asked the Italian and Tunisian government to collaborate in the search of their sons. There was a wide mobilization of civil society. I want to show you the video of one of the campaign. This is a campaign from a feminist collective from Italy that started regularly visiting the Tunisian families and organized several awareness-raising activities and demonstrations. And through this context, the Association of the Families of Missing Migrants took part in a mission to Italy at the end of January 2012. Some of them also managed to meet the Italian President Napolitano during his visit to Tunisia on 16 May 2012. And finally, the Italian-Tunisian institution collaborated and compared the fingerprints of the disappeared migrants with those of migrants in Italian detention centers, with negative results, but still different representatives of Tunisian and Italian institutions gave opposing responses to the families, raising doubts on the quality of the investigation. But apart from these disappointing results, we can observe that the creation of social ties between Tunisian and foreign civil societies and the families of the missing migrants helped them to make their voices heard, and it has played an important role in raising the issue onto an international level. Conclusions. To conclude, the political and social change in Tunisia opened up a space for freedom and stimulated the establishment of a direct and active contact between foreign civil society associations working on migration issues and migrant social groups in the country of origin. This process is creating social ties between people who do not share national, ethnic, religious, or family bonds, rather whose sense of belonging to a group is tied to the fact that they share the same objective and the same fight in this case. In some cases, these social ties are consolidating and becoming more stable because of their institutionalization within civil society associations who are recognized by the government and partially involved in the decision-making process. Finally, as the previous example showed, these new social ties represent an unprecedented opportunity for exchange of knowledge and information and can improve the agency of migrants and the social group and contribute in raising awareness about migration issues at the Tunisian decision-making level and within the national and international debates.
Thank you very much.
For more information about the different ways you can stay updated and engaged with the work of the Refugee Study Centre, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk/connect.